This is a Glassbox Media Podcast.
To bring to your attention.
Listening.
So, number one, today I wake up to lovely cuddles from Eric, and I don't know how we got on this conversation. We were talking about hair. Oh, he's like, oh, I love your hair. He's like, but I miss my salt and pepper or whatever, because Cassie, you hooked me up this week and covered those crazy ass witch hairs I had going on. Well, he was talking about missing them, and he's like, at least.
Oh, no.
He goes, it was always fun when I find them everywhere. And he says he keeps finding them in his butt.
Well, oh, okay.
And I was like, what?
What? I mean, I find my own hairs in my own butt crack.
So I was like, first of all, how is my hair getting in your butt? And he's
that
like,
I don't know.
He's like, oh, I think I'm like, he's like, when I poop, he's like, anyone who slept with you is
what?
Eating your hair.
What?
And I said, what?
Oh,
so
no.
I have to know.
Wait, no. I'm sorry. Also, pause. He means inside.
No.
Like, not no. Like, okay, because as women, we know if you shower and you're shedding a lot of hair, like, occasionally, mm-hmm. like, you can find hair places,
right.
But it's usually external.
Yes. No, he is
no.
saying that
no.
he poops no. my hair.
No.
No, he didn't.
No.
No. No.
Wow, so, what a disgusting no. way to start off this podcast, first
no.
of all.
No. No.
I just want to. No. come no. out the gate and say that.
And so that's no. why I was wondering. He's like your hair. He's like, it's so crazy. It's beautiful. It's long. He's like, but it gets everywhere. And he's like, mm-mm. and he's like, I guarantee anyone that you've slept with has eaten your hair.
Mm-mm.
I mm-mm. don't.
I need mm-mm. to know if it's true.
Listen, listeners, write in, because like, it is not something I've ever mm-mm. experienced, but I've never dated somebody who has really long hair. However, I would like to say, if it's happening to him, wouldn't it be happening to you too? If your hair
right?
is everywhere and it's like in the right. bed and that's how
he's
eating
it,
then like.
Also, I don't know if I would notice if there was hair in my poop.
Thank you. Like, how does he, what's he, like, getting, diving in there? Like, what's he got? Like,
does he have a poop fucking knife?
Oh. I hate everything about this. I'm going to say no, is what I'm going to say. If you guys like have, like, evidence to the contrary, please let us know. I'm sure our
no,
Facebook
don't.
Group will turn up with their opinions.
Yes.
But
yes.
It's,
I need
it's,
answers.
I think no. Mm-mm. But okay. But while we're on the topic of mysterious questions, this came up on my Instagram the other day, and it's from Reddit. And like, legit, it made me think, because I don't know the answer. And so I need some of our male listeners to write in and let us know. Okay. So this was on Reddit. How can guys fuck so hard? It sounds like a white man running in flip-flops, but when they get tapped on the balls, it's painful and nauseating. I'm a female and just genuinely confused about ball pain. And it made me think, yeah, what is that? It's like they can
they
slap.
Literally, yeah.
And it's like not a problem, but if you just like lean on it the wrong way.
Oh, yeah.
Then they're in like excruciating
or even, like,
pain.
Flick it, and not even that hard. Like,
so,
you're absolutely right.
What is that? I'd never thought hard about it before, but now that the question has been posed,
I feel like I need to go pull Chris on this.
Yeah, like right? Like, why? Is it where it's hitting? Is it because there's so much blood rushing to that area? Like, why?
You'd think that'd be worse, right?
Right. Yeah, and. I've always wondered, like, why they don't, like, sit on it all the time. Mm. You know what I mean? And wouldn't that hurt just as much?
Mm. I don't know.
Balls are really confusing. I can't imagine carrying something like that around.
Are men, I carry tits. That's good enough. Are men listening to this and thinking that we're as dumb as we think men are when we're like, you pee out of your...
Totally. No, it's really weird. I think that it would be a really cool invention for the world if there was some sort of thing that could make it so that you could feel what it was like to be a guy for one day. That's all and I would vice want versa. Was one day and vice versa.
I think that if we had that technology, we would have to make every kid in middle school health class do it for one day so that we can have just increase our empathy.
Yep. Yep.
For people who have different parts than you.
Be a girl on day two of period.
Mm-hmm.
That's when you get to be a girl.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Worst day, day one.
Oh, I don't know. Day two is pretty bad for me. Yeah. I mean, it's all not good.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They all have their fun little foibles. Day two is usually just like heaviest for me.
Yeah.
I just want them to deal with that.
Mm-hmm. And you know, fine. I'll have some balls for one day. You get to, you know, kick them once so I know what you're talking about whenever.
Oh, my gosh. So, yeah, if guys could write in and let us know, I want to know what it is like to have balls. I want a long, descriptive paragraph. Write a report.
This is your essay.
Wow. You're like, not double spaced, single spaced.
What is it like to have balls? I need to know. I might Google it and see what comes up when we're done with this podcast. Oh, speaking of Googling, I don't know what I was Googling today, but I landed on, and this is in fucking infuriating to me. I mean, it made me hot.
Uh-oh.
So I guess Kim Kardashian made her closest circle of friends quarantine for 2 weeks and then gathered everybody together onto a private jet, flew to a private island, and had a huge 40th birthday party with no masks, nothing, just all sorts of fun and games and frivolity, and had this long Instagram post about all the fun and everything they had, whilst simultaneously being like, I'm so humbly grateful. Like, I know this is a hard year for everybody. Hashtag this is 40. And I'm like, I have never. Now, listen, I get it. Like, I am not somebody that like begrudges people for earning a living or earning their money and how they want to spend their money. But somehow during this year and everything that everybody's had to go through, I'm like fucking over the whole like keeping up with Kardashians and just like.
I think a lot of people are.
It's been canceled.
I really feel like celebrity culture has taken a nosedive this year, and it's just because we can't. Like, we can't deal. You know, and there's a time and a place. Like I said, I've been watching so much Real Housewives, and a lot of it is that. And so there is. Part of your mind wants to escape into something else. Yeah. And I understand like that part of it. But for Kim Kardashian, it's like this is her real life. And like this is what she's doing. And again, like I don't want to begrudge people. I do understand how hard it is. And I understand that like if a lot of us had money, would we be tempted to do something similar? Like I get it. But it's the need, this like obsessive need. And I understand it's the way that they make their money. But it's this like obsessive need to flaunt it, to put it online, to share it all over the place.
That's fine. But I don't want to fucking look at it with all the things that are going on in this world. And I'm like, you could have spent your money doing countless number of fucking things. Not that you have to constantly like, you know, devote all your life or all your money to causes or whatever, but it just felt so tone deaf to me. Like, I just...
Well, but the thing is, they are tone deaf. They can't help but be tone deaf. If you have that much money, you're not a normal person anymore. I know I've said this on the podcast before. It's just not possible. You're living in a completely different world that's disconnected from the rest of us. You just, you can't help but be out of touch. Like, there's just no way.
So I think that to make it up to us that she should sponsor the July 23rd birthday party. I think she should at least pay for DJ Khaled. Yeah.
I mean, I think the listeners should know that we were fully planning that party. Like, we tried to find DJ Khaled on Cameo, but he is not on Cameo. So we're looking for plans. So if you know him personally, you know, shoot him a reach DM.
Out. Exactly.
Reach out. Okay, I have very important news I need to discuss with you guys. It's very important. And that is that Bud Light Seltzer has put out
I'm already out
an ugly sweater pack. And I feel like we owe it to the listeners. We have to. It's not negotiable.
I have not tried Bud Light Seltzers, and to TBH, a lot of people have said that they're pretty good.
I've not tried them either. Now,
I've heard.
There's only two flavors in here that look even remotely drinkable.
Palatable.
To me.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
So here's the flavors. There's cranberry, which sounds good to me, actually.
Okay. Yeah.
Apple crisp. Probably not that bad. Mm. Ginger snap. Now, that one I'm on the fence about, because I'm like, is it like ginger beer seltzer?
I bet it would taste like a Moscow
like
Mule.
Ginger ale.
That would be good.
I feel like that would be okay, unless they're trying to make it sweet like a ginger snap cookie, in which case that would be gross. Now, this is the one that I'm like, it's a hard pass for me, dog. I'll try it for the sake
cone.
Of the podcast.
Pumpkin.
Pine cone.
It's pumpkin, isn't it?
Peppermint patty.
Oh.
You know how I feel. Mm. It's like... somebody, it's that whole mint chocolate chip. I'm like,
I
who's
don't
eating
dig
ice
it.
Cream and wants to put toothpaste in it?
I don't
Nobody.
Exactly.
Oh,
no,
I love
but people
mint.
Love that shit. Like, people.
I love mint chocolate.
Ooh, God, no.
But not as a fucking seltzer beverage.
Okay.
Gross.
Okay, here's what we're going to do. We are going to do a Patreon tasting
Yes.
of said pack. Mm-hmm. And we'll make it available to anybody on Patreon. So a video of us going through and tasting it so that you don't have to. You can watch us, our faces. We won't be able to hide the sheer delight or utter disgust that we have. So, we'll try to do it. Is it out now?
I think it was just released.
Okay.
Ready for the holidays, because we're in November now. Okay. So we will do it. I am traveling home. And then, of course, I'll need to quarantine for a couple of weeks. And then maybe we can.
So like beginning of December?
Yeah.
That way we were all tested and cored.
Yes. Oh, okay. I love that idea.
I'm on board. But I read that and I was just like, oh, goddamn. Bud Light, you hopped on it fast.
They're ready for Christmas. Oh my God.
Everybody is. God, there's so much stuff out already. I'm like, let Halloween happen, people.
But I mean, how much of Halloween is happening? Yeah, I mean, by the time this episode comes out, Halloween will be behind us. So I guess we will see the fuckery, because there will be fuckery all over social media, I am sure. And we will have seen it by the time this podcast comes out, but we are recording pre-Halloween. And I mean, I was just thinking today, like, even Halloween candy, like, I told Anthony, I'm like, go buy us bags of Halloween candy, because no, there aren't trick-or-treaters. So the fact that there's even Halloween candy to be bought seems why?
The second those pumpkin patches turn over into Christmas tree things, I'm getting a tree hella fucking early this year.
Yeah.
Hell yeah.
And I'm not that person, but I'm
me neither.
Like, I fucking need Christmas or something. Like,
I feel
soon.
The same way. I am a hard do not put your Christmas tree up until Thanksgiving person. Like, I don't put my Christmas tree up until Thanksgiving. I've always been like that. I'm like, let Thanksgiving have its day, let it have its moment to shine in the sun. But this year, I'm like, I need all the holidays at once. Can we have pumpkins and turkeys and trees at the same time? Because like,
yes, we can. We can do what we want. 2020.
Apparently, we make our own rules this year.
That's my Jesus. That's my stance that I'm standing on for my presidential campaign.
Can we make shirts? Like, we do what we want. 2020. Except for no. We can't do that because there are too many people doing what they want.
True.
That's why we're in this situation.
That's why we're here. Yep. Exactly. Oh my God.
Ugh. I do what I want alone. 2020.
By myself. Well, who should we fuck, marry, kill this week?
God, I don't know. I'm so disconnected from everything. Mm-hmm. I don't even know what's going on in the world. I really don't.
Yeah, you haven't missed anything, really. It's still the same out here. Honestly, 100%. Nothing has changed.
Oh, God.
Which is depressing.
I mean, it's half depressing, half comforting, I guess, since I really haven't been paying attention. Yeah. But,
did we do Bruce Willis?
No.
Bruce Willis characters.
We got to do Die Hard.
Yeah.
Speaking of Christmas, the classic Christmas movie.
Yeah, Die Hard. Fifth Element.
Okay.
Oh.
Gosh, I gotta look up the name. So it's John McClane from Die Hard.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Meat Popsicle. Yeah, she knows it's a multipass. Anyway, we're in love.
I haven't seen that movie in forever. I love that movie.
Corbin Dallas.
Multipass.
From The Fifth Element. And let's see, Pulp Fiction?
Oh, yes.
Perfect.
And that dude who rides the motorcycle, Butch Coolidge, of course, that's his name. Butch Coolidge, Corbin Dallas, and John McClane.
Okay.
Okay.
Ooh.
Mm. Kind of right, hard, actually.
I'm fucking Butch Coolidge because I shouldn't.
You really shouldn't. He is kind of a dick.
No, you really shouldn't.
He's kind of a dick, but holy crap. That sex is going to be.
But I thought you don't do motorcycles.
I do not. It's going to be a crazy night. we're going to make like a hard left at the yayo and go all night. That shit is going to be bad. I am going to have the biggest shame receipt.
Oh,
and I
no.
will tell no one about how dangerous that night was. It will be a secret.
Oh, no.
And I will never tell anyone, but it will haunt my dreams.
So if you make it out alive, it will be great? Question mark?
Yes. Yes. Be one of those. I had a couple of nights like that, single nights where I've like a little bit self-destructive, not altogether safe, but really fucking
I've had a
fun.
Sure. Those nights.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay. I think we've all had a few of those nights.
Exactly. Yeah. You don't tell anybody about them.
Yes.
Keep them buried deep down and never bring it up
buried
again.
Buried deep. Buried deep. Locked in your lockbox.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. Who are you going to marry?
I'm going to marry Fifth Element. I'm going to marry Corbin Dallas. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. He's got a sense of humor, and so does John McClane from Die Hard.
Mm-hmm.
But... John McClane from Die Hard is just, I don't know. I can't put my finger on why I wouldn't want to marry him.
I know why I wouldn't want to marry him. I feel like.
John McClane?
Yes. I feel like he's a little, and I watched Die Hard.
He would do anything to save you.
He would.
But he wouldn't do anything to keep me. There was a reason why she was like over it.
Yes. I feel like there's a little bit of a misogynistic streak in him. Because I think it's hinted at in the movie that he couldn't deal with the fact that she was like good at her job and like making a lot of money because she was working.
Well, you're just going to have to get over it.
Yeah. And he did, I guess. But So for me, okay, I'm going to fuck John McClane because. Okay. There's something about that hero complex that I bet it's going to be, he's strong, right?
He's got something to prove.
He'll walk on glass for you. He really will. So I'm like, yeah, I feel like it would be just one night. I feel like it would be good. I feel like he would fuck well.
You don't marry him though.
No, no. And I'm going to marry Corbin Dallas because, okay, yes, he has his own issues. All right. He's got his own problems, but he is funny. And we all know I like a funny guy. So I do. Funny. And he's still hot and he would still try and save you. Right. Now, that movie, I love The Fifth Element. I have issues with the, like, I'm a sexy baby because I don't know what stuff is and that makes me hot, which I feel like they do in that movie.
Totally.
You know, because she's like, I don't know how to person. And he's like, don't worry, I'll take care of you.
I'll person for you.
But with all that said, I feel like he deep down wants the relationship. Right. He wants that committed relationship somewhere deep inside. Yeah. So I am going to marry him. And yeah, I can't. What's his name? Butch. OK. Already. First of all, I can't marry a man named Butch. Can't
no,
do
you
it.
You can't marry him. You can fuck him.
You,
I mean,
can.
You wouldn't say his name in bed.
No. No.
There's just some names you don't call out in bed. And I feel like Butch is up there for me.
It's 100%. Yeah. You got to give him a nickname. You got to find something else to say. But yeah, no, I feel like, yes, it might be fun, but that is just a dirty dick scenario that I would never feel clean again. No. I'm not sure I would. So, yeah.
Well, he got that watch from what's his name that was shoved up his ass all that time. So that also makes me nervous. Yeah. He still carries that shit around. He was super upset about it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Oh, God.
Ooh, yeah. Okay. So, okay. I have to kill Butch. He's horrible.
So
he's
aggro. Horrible. Like,
And honestly, there is kind of a sexy scene with him and Chickface, and he just doesn't look like he's going to try hard. He's tired. He's been in a fight. He's beaten people up. I mean, he's a boxer. Like, dude
and it would be exhausting to date someone who fights all the time. Ugh. Like, I don't have the energy to be like pulling you off of people.
No one's saying anything about going out on
a
date.
You're right.
No. Mm-hmm. No, we're talking about fucking.
Yeah. You're right.
And I'm not going to do either of those things. I have to kill Butch. He gets on my nerves. His girlfriend gets on my nerves.
She's annoying too. Yeah, that's for real.
Oh, yeah. It's hard too because I think the first time I watched it, I was younger and I definitely had a more misogynistic view on life. And I was like, oh, she's so annoying. But then I'm like, no, he's a fucking dick.
He is a dick, but she's still annoying.
He's terrible. She's still annoying, but he's a dick.
Yeah, he's terrible to her.
So I got to kill him. I'm going to. This was where I was a little torn. But here's what I'm going to say. I'm going to fuck Corbin Dallas.
All right.
Because I think Corbin would be the most fun.
Mm-hmm.
I do. And I think that, but he's a fucking loser. Like, honestly, if you're really, when it comes down to brass tacks, he had to find the one girl who didn't know how to human just to find somebody to be with.
You're so not wrong.
That makes me nervous.
You know what? This all tracks for all of us. It actually really does. Yeah. I mean...
Yeah. Yeah.
And then I'm going to marry the big meathead. McClane.
You'd
because
run circles around him. He would.
I
be
would.
He'd be wrapped around your finger.
Oh, yeah, I would. Yeah. I got to be honest. And I think that when it comes down to it, once I put him in his place, I think he'd be a good husband. I mean, definitely he'd do anything for you.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Walk on glass, bitch.
That's true. So, okay, all
he'd
all
even
good
go
choices.
After Snape.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Well, hopefully, I live through my night with Butch. So.
I mean, you're gonna have to tell us about it if it were to happen. You can't keep that shit a secret, not from us, at least. I want to know all the details if you survive that evening.
Yeah, because part of it is like I'm not like the chick that he's with in Pulp Fiction, and I feel like sometimes with guys like that. You know what I mean? Like, I feel sometimes like that's when I'm almost at my most confident because I don't give a fuck. I'm not trying to date them or whatever. And I will give just as good as I get. So that's why
we should have done a Pulp Fiction.
Hugely destructive relationship. A Pulp Fiction
I feel
one?
Like we should do Pulp Fiction one, right? Like,
save it for next
we'll
week.
Do it next time. God knows there's enough men in that movie. There's plenty to pick from. It's like 80% of the cast is dudes.
True.
So, I watched it again not that long ago, and I swear to God, that like opening scene is still like, it's just so fucking good.
It is good.
The way that it's written, the way that it's performed, the way that it's shot is so funny still. Like, and just perfect. So, if you have.
I'm a big fan of his anyway, Quentin Tarantino. So that's, you know, that's always a tough game to play. Favorite Tarantino film.
Well, we can fuck, so marry, good. Kill Tarantino films if you want to.
We did.
Did we?
I feel like we did.
No, we did characters.
Tarantino characters.
Because we did Uma Thurman. Right.
Oh, we did actors. His rotation or whatever. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we definitely could. I could go Tarantino all day. So.
Well, I guess we should introduce ourselves. This is My Worst Date. Yeah. I'm Keegan.
I'm Cassie.
I'm Christina.
What's up?
What's up? Well, hey, do you guys want to take five and then we'll come back with stories?
Yes.
Yeah, I gotta get more wine.
Yeah.
Okay, and we're back. All right, so I will kick us off with stories. So this one is kind of unique for our dating stories. Okay. One evening, a friend and I were sitting at a high-top table in a nice bar/restaurant when a small, awkward-looking 50-something dude came in and sat at the table next to us, just a few feet away from us. He was dressed nerd nice and announced to the waiter that he was meeting someone there for dinner. He then pulled out a small, delicately wrapped package and placed it across the table. He ordered a drink and waited. And waited. After at least 30 minutes, he ordered an appetizer. Another hour went by and he told the waiter he wasn't sure what had happened to his friend and ordered a large entree for himself. Because he was sitting so close to us, my friend and I heard everything he'd said and really started feeling sorry for the guy. He looked pretty glum and kept glancing over at us, so we eventually made a bit of small talk with him. He was nice enough, but we kept it brief because we didn't want him glomming on. By this time, he had downed several drinks and eaten most of his meal, running up at least a $75 tab. He then got up and announced that he was going to the men's room, but only after folding his napkin nicely and placing it on his chair and setting his coaster on the top half of his finished drink, all indications not to clear his table because he wasn't done. He also left his little gift sitting on the table. After at least 45 minutes, our waiter, also his waiter, came over and asked us if we knew what happened to our friendly neighbor, or to our nerdy neighbor.
My friend
and I'd been talking and hadn't realized that he never came back from the men's room. Our waiter was sure he'd bailed on the check, but I defended him. I asked him to give the dude more time and walked back to the men's room to check on him. He was nowhere in the restaurant. Another 30 minutes went by. Yes, we were there a long time. And it was clear that Poindexter had dined and dashed, but he'd forgotten to take his gift. When I told the waiter he should open it, he said, as an employee here, I can't do that, but I can't stop a patron from doing it. So,
yes.
Well, I'd had more than a few drinks by that time. And that was all the invitation I needed. I grabbed it and ripped it open. It was a small box jammed with nothing but crumpled up newspaper. It was then that it finally dawned on all of us. The guy had staged the whole night. Nice clothes, imaginary date, fake gift, folded napkin, coaster covered drink, sad eyes, men's room announcement, just to steal a meal.
What is this, Ocean's fucking 11?
He planned this whole thing out. We gave our waiter a nice tip and left shaking our heads, but still smiling. Oh my God.
Dude,
that's so crazy. Dude, the first restaurant that I worked for after high school, they would make you pay the server for walkouts.
That's what I've always heard, is that the server has to pay if somebody dines and dashes. Part of the reason why I've never done it.
Yeah.
That's horrible.
Terrible. But the amount of effort that that guy put into getting a free meal.
It's like, kind of impressive.
Put that into your job and then you can afford it, sir. Please. Yep. Wow. Good Lord.
But sometimes I wonder, and like, can they not afford it, or are they just doing it because they like want the thrill or something, you know?
Yeah. Mm. Ugh.
Wow.
I don't know. He wrapped a gift. Motherfucker, like, got home.
Levels.
He took out wrapping paper.
That's levels, dude. Oh. Wow. Okay. So the story I got from Reddit, it goes, this guy and I liked each other on and off for a while. We both came from the same hometown and had gone to different high schools. A few times a year, it would seem that we'd bump into each other as we rotated in some of the same friend groups, especially in the latter part of high school.
Sounds like a small town.
After graduation. Yep. When we started going together, going to get-togethers and parties, we'd bump into each other after months and months of not seeing each other, reconnect and have a great time together, and then go our separate ways with the promise to stay in contact and catch up sometime. But of course, that would never happen. Life would get in the way and the cycle repeated. This went on from about the ages of 16 through 19 when I moved away for college. A year or so later, I bumped into him at college. We had worked for 2 years after finishing high school and was now studying. We exchanged numbers and have a quick catch up between classes, and he asks if it's okay to ask me out sometime. Great, I thought. We got along super well as friends, and we both liked each other in the past, so I was looking forward to getting to know him on a deeper level. He texts me about a week later and asks if I'd like to have lunch with him the next day. I agree. We make plans for the next afternoon. The date started out well. We knew each other beforehand, so there wasn't as much awkwardness or nervousness. We have a bit in common, and the conversation was easy. The waitress comes over and asks if we'd like more drinks. And after she leaves, he asks if I'd noticed anything about her. I was confused and said, no. You don't notice she was checking me out? He asked me.
Okay, that all is right. No. Don't
hard
do
pass
that on a date.
She may have done, but I, in all honesty, I wasn't paying much attention
and
to her.
And why would you point it out? Like, yeah. Ugh.
I was pretty certain she hadn't, but I didn't think too much of it. That was until we went for a walk through town afterwards. The restaurant was near to a beach, so we went for a walk through town and along the boardwalk. Nearly every woman we passed, he would make comments about her looking at
him. Oh, shut up.
Even if the woman wasn't even facing
us. Oh, my God.
Even if she didn't even look at us, she apparently was checking him out. For the next hour while he walked, I was subjected to comments like, did you seriously see that? She was looking straight at me. Oh, my God.
Do men think this makes them look more desirable? Like, why?
I don't know. We went to a small shop to get milkshakes, and he whispered to me that the lady who had made our order, that she was eye fucking.
All right,
him.
Goodbye. We're done. We're done, sir. This date is over.
Oh my to this God. Day, I don't know why he was doing that. I don't know if he did all that at the time, whenever he was out, or if it was just to elicit a jealous reaction from me in the hopes that I would get all territorial over
he
him.
He did it because he's 19,
boosting his ego. Oh, totally.
Yeah.
Oh,
yes.
Like, yeah. I don't know, but I felt super awkward and he seemed oblivious to me. His only focus were the other women we were walking past and him trying to convince me that he lived in a world where every single woman was attracted to him. He asks me out again in the next weekend, but I declined and told him that I didn't think it would work out romantically. He interpreted this as me admitting to being jealous of the other women. I told him, no, that was not the case. And I explained that it was actually felt a little uncomfortable with his constant pointing out of the women, how they had all wanted to bed him.
Oh, yeah. Thanks, James Bond.
Right. He then took this to mean that I was trying to be possessive of him. And again, I disagreed. We had a bit of pointless back and forth with him insisting that I was jealous. I got fed up after that and wished him well and deleted his number.
Oh, you want me to be jealous so bad, sweetie?
So bad. Mm. the change in this guy from when we had partied together and been friends to when we went out was just incredible. As friends, I had never had any inkling or suspicions that he thought himself as the gift to womankind. If anything, it was quite the opposite. He was just so kind and down to earth. There is a kind of silver lining to this story. As another girl from our college he had been out with messaged me over social media after she had spent their date pulling the same stunt, but mentioning me by name. We got to talking, and now we're really good friends and still see each other to this day.
Oh, awesome.
Happy ending. Right? You know, I can only hope that, like, that was a really long time ago, and now he's an adult, and now he has shame receipts that wake him up in the middle of the night cringing right. about that behavior with some perspective. Because I know I did some weird attention-seeking behavior my teens that now I'm like, God, that was so transparently, like, dumb.
Desperate.
Yeah.
In your teens? I did some of that stuff last year. So. Yeah.
Oh, good.
No. Yeah, it's bad. All right, you guys, this is a bit of a journey.
Do you have an actual printout?
I have a printout.
No. Yes.
Oh, my God.
You have a piece of paper.
Yes. So I found this incredible story on Reddit, and I messaged, because we usually do, message the people. Yeah. And so I got talking with the author. The guy's name's Chris Bowden. He has a book that he's written on Amazon. His writing is absolutely hysterical. I was dying.
Oh, damn.
So he has a whole book. If you like this story, I'll put the link in the show notes so you guys can check it out. But yes, I'm going to share with you a story. I will preface it with a trigger warning.
Oh,
especially,
God.
Especially if you have a dick and balls.
Oh, no.
You are going to be very triggered by this story.
Oh, no.
I'm scared, and I don't have a dick and balls.
Was this...
Same.
Were we talking about this on this episode or on the shorty about...
Kicking the balls?
Kicking the balls.
I think it was the shorty.
Oh, okay.
No, well, I think anyways. It was this one where white man running in flip-flops. Yeah, that's this one.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Anyways. Okay. So he starts. Yes, I know. I'm a complete fucking idiot. Let's just get that out of the way from the start. My only defense was that I was a teenager in the 90s at the time.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. That's valid. It's a valid defense. Mm-hmm.
I was 16, and the world as I knew it revolved entirely around my radiant affections for one hell of an awesome girl.
Oh.
Miraculously, she was also my steady girlfriend. We had a magnificent system that involved a standing weekly date. This almost always consisted of exactly three things: dinner, a movie, and furious, passionate, awkward sex that only inexperienced young lovers can have in the confines of an automobile.
Yes.
Sounds.
I'm like.
Flashbacks.
I'm
flashbacks.
Having recovered memories. It's like making me sweat. Oh, no.
On the right day of the week, you could catch a second-run movie at the Alpine Twin for just a couple bucks. It was a great time to be young and in love. God is not without a sense of humor, however, and one particular week, fate would throw me a curve. A movie had just come out that her father wanted to see. They decided it would be a great time to join us on our weekly movie night for a wholesome double date.
Never. I don't even want to do that now. Like, as an adult, I'm like, I'm not trying. No.
I was trapped. I couldn't say no. Her dad was a towering giant of brooding scowls who instilled the fear of God in me. So we all met at her house. The whole family piled into her car and off we went. Now, it had never for a moment crossed my mind that we didn't all have to go to the same movie. So they went to one movie and him and his girl went to another movie. And then they made the long walk to the back 40 of the parking lot in hand when their movie got out and hopped in the car.
No.
Concrete idea when her parents' movie would get out. So we were just hanging out, waiting, and of course sharing only the most chaste and pure of good Christian thoughts. Because sitting in a glass bubble in the middle of 1,000 cars is totally the best place to be doing such things, she pulls down his pants and starts giving him a blowjob.
Okay. Oh, no. Well, look, listen, I really want to judge them super hard right now, but I know that I did some real questionable shit for sure. Like some real dangerous on the line. You could fuck up your life with this move shit, which I feel like as a teenager, what they're doing is that. So
the good news was that at least I had a clear line of sight all the way up and would easily see anyone approaching from the theater. I kept a watchful lookout, and she decided to take action. In a matter of few seconds, she was sucking my dick like it was filled with her father's acceptance.
Oh! Oh, no.
Oh, my God.
Oh, no.
Not a moment later, I saw the crowd of people start pouring out of the theater doors. It didn't take me long to spot her parents. Hand in hand. Her dad's bright blue shirt stuck out in the crowd, even though they were still a quarter of a mile away. And then, at that exact moment, I fucked up. That's when I did one of the dumbest things in my entire life. I made a split-second trivial decision that would leave me scarred
forever. Oh, my God.
Oh, my God. I'm so nervous.
I'm so scared.
Now, what I could have done is simply reach down, gently pull her head out of my lap, and have a mildly disappointing end to some fun, gone on with my day and been just fine. What I did in a moment of youthful stupidity was say, "Your dad's coming," and sit straight up in my seat.
Oh, I'm worried about his penis.
And that is when shit got real.
No, no.
Please understand, what I'm about to describe is much like a car crash.
Oh, God.
Oh.
All of this transpired in just a moment, but that moment is burned into my brain forever. In one smooth, powerful moment, driven by pure reflex and fear, without a moment's conscious thought, she snapped her head up, bolted upright in her seat, and while making that transition, she stuffed my dick back into my jeans and ran that fucking zipper all the way home with the power of an angry linebacker.
Oh, no. So it's like a something.
How'd
like,
you get the beads above the frame?
Something about Mary. Moment. Oh, God, no. Oh.
The problem is I had never unbuttoned my pants, and it was a lot smaller when it came out 10 minutes ago than it was when she decided to cram it back through.
Why would she zip it? Why would she zip it? Why wouldn't she just let him do that?
It just wasn't situated as well as it needed to be. Then with the delicate touch of a bricklayer, she had yanked that zipper through several inches of my most delicate sensitivities and me one my Levi's.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
Oh, I was so absolutely scared. Convinced I was going to die.
I'm going to throw up.
The pain was far worse than what you imagine right now. It was radiant and consuming. She had caught roughly the entire front of the most sensitive skin I owned.
Oh!
And there was nothing I could do about it but sit there with tears running down my face and her parents approaching. I felt every bump in the road in between my own heartbeats as I throbbed in agony, sitting awkwardly in the back seat.
Oh, my God.
When her mom asked me if I was okay, I uttered the only word I could manage on the entire road home: allergies. We made it to her parents' house, said our goodbyes, and she walked me across the street to my car. I had never been to the med center before. My parents were on the rescue squad of the local volunteer fire department, so anything short of a sucking chest wound in my house was dealt with by someone running for the jump bag in Dad's truck. Any sort of injury was handled on only the best of equipment, the kitchen
table.
Do
you tell your parents
that your dick is zipped up into your pants?
Guys.
That's why I wasn't even slightly surprised when I walked in the front door and the triage nurse at the front counter stopped typing, looked me straight in the eye with genuine concern on her face and said, "Chris, are you okay?" It was my mom's friend.
No.
Not only did this woman know me, she'd known me since I'd had training wheels on my bike. I knew she was a nurse. Half the women in my world were nurses, and my mom was a nurse. How the hell was I supposed to remember that one of her best friends just so happened to work at the med center? No, ma'am, I said, and quickly added, wincing, please, please don't tell my mom. What happened? Show me what you did. Now, I grew up around trauma and emergency medicine.
Oh my God.
I was also well aware that the strongest, hardest, most stoic, most unimaginably unfucking phased woman you'll ever meet is a triage nurse. So I lifted up my shirt.
Oh.
I pray that you go your entire life and never once hear a triage nurse say, oh dear, when she looks at whatever injury you have. Oh. There was no paperwork, and my ass never touched one of those beige plastic chairs in the tiny waiting room. The doctor was right in.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Oh, no. I'm so nervous.
So I hear you've had an interesting evening. He pulled up a little rolling stools, put on a pair of gloves, and scooted up for a front row seat between my knees as I sat sideways off the edge of the table. We discussed how I got myself into this situation, and he surveyed the damage. The skin on the bottom of my shaft was peeking out through the golden teeth of the zipper.
No. Oh my God.
All the way from about half inch above the bottom of the zipper to the top. There was way more blood than I had noticed at first, and it had stained my pants several inches in every direction.
I really wish we had this on tape because all three of us are in separate locations and we are crouched down, hiding ourselves alone. We're alone. And I'm trying to hide.
I'm sweating right now, like profusely. He pulled out a pair of trauma shears and we discussed what he was going to do.
Oh my God. Christina, why are you doing this? I feel assaulted.
Horrible.
He planned on cutting my pants off around the zipper. I was fine with this. Off is good. Let's get this off. Free me from my golden restraints, good doctor. Then he said something you never, ever want to hear any manner of medical professional to say to you.
No.
We're going to go on three.
No, sir. No.
One.
No.
No.
There was no motherfucking two. Three was an outright lie. The way out was as blindingly fast and traumatic as the way in.
I have nowhere to hide. There's nowhere to go. I'm trapped.
The good side is it didn't actually hurt all that much when he did that. The bad side was the blood was now rushing to my dick and it was throbbing with every heartbeat. And it hurt like hell. We both took a moment to compose ourselves.
Oh, no.
Now I need a moment to compose myself.
Oh, my God.
And both spoke at the same moment, saying the exact same thing. Are you all right?
Are you all right? When you have to ask the doctor if he's all right. Oh, God.
I looked at the sad strip of hamburger laying in my lap.
No.
Surrounding by a terrifying amount of dried blood. It looked like Edward Scissorhands had given me an old fashioned.
Why are you doing this?
I asked what would happen if I got a hard-on. Would I bleed to death or something? He assured me that the last thing I was going to get in the immediate future would be a hard-on.
So I mean, he's still a teenage boy, though.
I thanked him for saving my manhood, secured my pants with my belt, and hid the giant square hole in the front under my shirt and headed home. I tossed my shredded jeans in the trash, took a shower that involved the creative application of a baggie and a rubber band that moments before had been holding the wing on my model airplane. He was right. I didn't have any danger of getting a hard-on for over a week. The throbbing pain became a dull ache that would hover just on the edge of being actively conscious of it. Sleeping was complicated, but I managed. After a few days, it didn't hurt at all. And a couple weeks later, I was back to all normal systems. But it'll be a cold day in hell before I let a woman zip me up again. I'll take care of that my own. Thank you. And thank you.
I would wear sweatpants for the rest of my life.
I need to know if they stayed together. Because, oh, God. Oh, you're maimed. You're maimed.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
He has a scar. And so I cut that story down like quite a bit, like conceptually. So if you liked it, please go check it out. When I read that story, was rolling.
Christina,
it's absolutely terrifying. Like, I do not have a dick and balls, but I imagine what would happen if that had happened to one of my labia.
Christina, so I have I have to tell you, there were moments during that story when I was genuinely mad at you.
Oh my God.
I feel like my ears were
assaulted.
Christina
didn't even do it.
Well, can you imagine? Here's the other side of the corn.
No.
So he was, did I just say the other side of the corn? I think I did. It's the other side of the corn.
Looks just like the first side. They look the same.
So the other side of the corn is
one of those multicolored corns.
What does that chick do? Because if it were me, like, okay, I'd
move to another town.
I would be mortified. If I liked a guy enough to suck his dick when I was 16 and then I zipped his dick and balls.
You're never sucking another dick again without a lot of therapy. A lot of therapy.
I think no one came out of this unscarred. And then what did her parents think when they got in the car and he's just crying all the way?
Allergies.
Oh, that is
horrible.
Oh my God.
Thinks I hate it.
My palms are sweaty.
Apparently he has a whole book full of stories, and if I didn't buy that like almost immediately,
I am interested because it was very good writing, but thank God you warned us because we couldn't have gotten into that blind. Oh man. Oh, we've had some horrifying stories on this show, but that's up there. It is.
Yeah.
Up there.
That's wow. Mortal wounds.
It's up there with the girl who had her clit almost rubbed off.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah.
Jesus. Ooh. Okay. All right. Well, we're about to take a hard turn. Sorry, everybody.
Okay.
So this is a little bit of a different Crazy in Love, kind of different than what we usually do, but I thought it was important. This is one of those times where I was literally 4 pages in to a different story and then was just like, you know what? My heart's not in it. My soul's not in it. So I kept those notes and I'll do that story another time. And instead, I am going to tell the story of Francine Hughes, AKA the Burning Bed Case.
Yep.
Okay. So all of my information, the New Yorker did a documentary and they put up like a little short kind of 15-minute video on that. So I watched that. That's on YouTube. They also had an article that corresponded with it. History.com, the Lansing State Journal.com. So that's where I got all of my info. Okay. So on the evening of, and also everyone, because I'm sure you can hear it in my voice, I'm like kind of under the weather. So that's why I sound like this. On the evening of March 9th, 1977, Francine Hughes goes into the Lansing, Michigan police station, and she tells the police that she has just lit her house on fire with her husband inside. So Francine Hughes was born in Stockbridge, Michigan. Her father was a farm worker and an abusive alcoholic. So Francine grew up watching her mother get beaten by her father and later recalled that her mother told her that, quote, you did what's best for your husband. So that's just your role.
Wow.
And that's just what you're supposed to do. So at the age of 16.
Too often, like, it's what's so hard is that you don't venture out of your comfort zone. Mm-hmm. So if that's what you grow up with, that's mm-hmm. what you're comfortable with, even though it's anyways.
Well, in this case, it also pushed her out of the house early, right? Because, like, who wants to live in an environment like that? Right. So at the age...
You're looking for your escape route from a very early age.
Yeah, yeah. And so she drops out of school at 16 and goes off and marries James Mickey Hughes. So in the beginning, of course, like most abusive relationships, you know, they're both teenagers and... It didn't start off abusive because it never does. It's like it's not like you go on a first date with somebody and they punch you in the face. You know what I mean? That's not how it happens. Nope. But it was very shortly after their marriage that the abuse began. So Francine would later recall that very early into their marriage, she bought some new clothes. And when she came home, he physically ripped them off of her. And she said, I don't know whether I looked too pretty or what, but he didn't want me to look that way. So in the beginning, he seemed remorseful. Again, very standard abuser
typical
behavior. So he was remorseful at first, but as time went on, the abuse became a pattern and that remorse kind of just faded away. It just became part of their relationship, part of their marriage. So soon, Francine had four children and a husband who spent most of their money on alcohol. In an interview I saw with one of their sons, he recalled that they would often go without food because their father spent all of their money on booze.
Oh,
so
my God.
He said he remembered their mother popping popcorn for them and mixing grape jelly with water so that they would have something to drink so that they didn't starve. And all of the children, you know, loved their mom. They said that, like, she was the only bright spot in their home and that she did everything that she could to shield them from as much abuse as possible and to make sure that they could survive without going hungry. He also recalled seeing his dad beat his mom viciously. He talks about it in that video and said that the slightest things could set him off, even if she just looked at him the wrong way or if she had the wrong inflection in her voice when she spoke to him. Like, it was, there was nothing she could do right.
Living under those conditions is the absolute worst.
It's hell.
I mean, honestly.
It's hell. And
I mean,
not only
you
that,
can't
but
do anything right.
Doing it as a teenager or just barely above your teenager when that's all that you're used to in life. So, like, for people that like to be Judge Judy's and be like, I would have blah, blah, blah. It's like,
yeah, of course.
Well, and the thing is, she did try. Like, she tried to go to school a few times. He, quote unquote, let her do that for a little while. And then he would get angry and put a stop to it every single time. So there were things that she did where she tried. But her children were even like, you know, because children have complicated relationships with their parents, right? And even if a parent is abusive, typically there's still love there. But her kids, as young as seven, one of them went on the stand and was basically like, that living in that house was miserable. Like, our dad was terrible, like, and scary. So in 1971, Francine spoke with a local social worker and decided to divorce Mickey. But he pretty much ignored the divorce decree. He came and went at will and continued to beat her. Still, she somehow managed, and this is a big thing, she managed to keep the boundary of him not moving back in, right? Which is kind of a big thing, right? Like, so yes, it's still terrible, but at least there's some kind of boundary there. The divorce is final. They are divorced and he's not living in the home. However,
And this is also like the 70s.
Early 70s, 1971.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, but that only lasted literally like a month. And then he got into a really bad car accident where he was seriously injured. And she took him back in and nursed him back to health. And when he recovered, the abuse was worse than ever. It was worse than it was before. So over the years, Francine had called the police on Mickey numerous times. Each time they would arrive to the home, they'd see that Francine had been clearly abused. Like, there were bruises, there was blood. It was very obvious that she'd been abused. But wife beating was seen as a family issue. And since the police had not actually witnessed the violence themselves, All they would do was write a report documenting the incident and then leave. The only times Mickey was actually arrested during these visits are the times when he became belligerent with the officers themselves. It's the only time he was arrested. So when the officers would leave, or when Mickey would get back from jail after being arrested, the beatings would be worse. Of course.
Of course.
Because, like, now you've tried to do something about it. So on March 9th, 1977, Mickey learned that his wife, Francine, was trying to enroll in secretarial school, which sent him into a rage. He brutally beat Francine. He forced Francine to gather her books, ripped them up, and forced her to put them in the burn barrel in the backyard and set them on fire. He demanded that she drop out, and he said that if she didn't, then he would destroy her vehicle so that she couldn't get to school. So she was terrified, of course, and called the police. And when they arrived, they took her statement, but they said that there was nothing they could do. And in front of the police, Mickey said that after they left, he would kill her for this, that it was all over for her. And they left. They left her there with him without arresting him. So
it's disgusting.
Mm-hmm. After they were gone, he subjected her to a particularly humiliating beating. Later on, she would recall saying, quote, smashing food in the kitchen, dumping out the garbage, rubbing it in my hair, hitting me. And then he also raped her, something that he had done during these beatings for years. And she said, quote, I thought I'm never coming back, never. And then I thought, because there won't be anything to come back to, that's when I decided I would burn everything. So one of her children,
burn it down.
Mm-hmm, one of her children was out of the house at the time. So she decided to wait until he was home. And by the time he arrived home, Mickey was passed out in a drunken stupor in their bed. So she loaded the kids into the car and then went back in the house. She poured gasoline all around the perimeter of Mickey's bed, lit a match, and set the house on fire. and everybody
in the world breathed a sigh of relief because mm-hmm. there's no longer a piece of shit.
One less piece of shit. She said, quote, I was thinking about all the things that had happened to me, all the times he had hurt me and how he hurt the kids. I stood still for a moment, hesitating, and a voice urged me on. It whispered, do it, do it. After getting into the car, she drove straight to the police station and she told the officers what she'd done. By the time the firefighters reached the house, Mickey was dead of smoke inhalation. And so Francine was arrested and charged with first degree murder. Even though there was a record of domestic abuse against her, the common consensus within law enforcement was basically like, it sucks that this happens to you, that's happened to you, and like we feel bad that your husband was a piece of shit, but you had other options, so you shouldn't have killed him.
No, she didn't.
What are those other
options? No, she didn't.
Like when I watched this interview, when I watched that like video, one of the prosecutors was basically like, you can't take the law into your own hands. Like it's terrible that this happened, but like you could have taken the kids and just disappeared. But like, how?
Easily.
With what money? Know. Like, with right. what? How would you do that? With no resources? You know, and
up and leave.
Yeah.
On our next episode of Up and Leave. Yeah.
Up and left.
Up and left.
Up and gone.
Oh my God. Up and left. How to do it with no money, with a fucking crazy person on your tail, and the cops, like, don't do shit.
Right. All, and like, and one of the sons, one of the sons was basically like, he would tell her all the time, like, bitch, if you left, I'd find you and I'd kill you. And like, there was no concept at all about the psychological trauma that happened within abusive relationships like this. So you have, you know, these two white dudes in the 70s, the prosecutors, who have no fucking understanding at all about this, who are just basically like, well, but you can't kill him though. So too bad.
And this is what's so sad about this story is that number one, it was not that long ago.
Not at all.
Not even a lifetime ago.
Mm-hmm.
And how long has shit like this been going on? Forever. Ages and ages and ages. And so this is an important story because in a way she's a martyr.
Mm-hmm.
And she did help progress
100%.
A lot of things forward.
Oh, 100%.
And it just sucks. It sucks the hand that she was dealt, and at least there's, you know, some forward thinking, and she brought attention to this.
But 100%.
It breaks my heart for what she had to go through.
Me too. So also because of the way that self-defense laws were written, it didn't look like she would be able to get off on a self-defense strategy because she waited hours after the beating and rape to kill him. So it looked like a losing case. It didn't look like something she'd be able to win. Still, somehow this case managed to gain national attention. So the second wave feminist movement, you know, had gained full steam at this point, and grassroots feminist movements had taken on domestic violence causes since even in the 1970s. The police and courts had turned a blind eye to domestic violence and domestic rape cases. In 1977, which was the same year that Francine killed her husband, the FBI had reported that spousal abuse was the United States' most underreported crime. Mm-hmm. At that time. And the year before, in 1976, a group of activists came before New York City Councilman Leon A. Katz at a public safety hearing about this issue. And he said to them, quote, "Do we break up a marriage simply because a man beats his wife?"
Wow.
Speaking of city council meetings, did you see the video of this chick? I forget where she was, like Kansas or something, reading these fucking, yes, it was Kansas City, like police department, like city commission meeting or something like that. And she reads them to filth. It is fantastic.
I've seen it going around and I haven't watched it yet, but I will.
Shit.
You know I will. Sometimes these people have to be dressed down. That's the thing. Whenever people talk about, like, you know, that this is inappropriate to, like, speak to people this way, think about this. Hmm. Think about the fact that it was 1976, dude. That's not very long ago. And you have somebody with a public platform, a city councilman, saying to your face that it's okay to... we can't break up a marriage just simply because a man beats his wife.
No, and we have people being confirmed to the Supreme fucking Court right now that think crazy fucking shit. And that's the reason why it's so important, is that the 70s were not that long ago. And if you think that, you know, I have a brother who is married to a lovely gentleman who I'm fucking scared shitless for if his marriage is going to be still legal. Mm-hmm. I have a fucking body that I have the right to choose what I fucking want to do with it. There's a million different things. And it's just like,
and we're going to look back on 2020 in 30 years from now, and we're going to say, can you fucking believe how archaic this seems?
We have a literal handmaid on our Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. Legitimately fucking handmaid.
I know, that's right. So Francine's lawyer, Arjun Gridanis, recalled that Mickey had been asleep, and he said, quote, "I did not think that I could convince the jury necessarily that she was not guilty because she was defending herself. So I used the temporary insanity hook." So he told the court that Mickey Hughes was a persistent wife beater, that the beatings took place even after the marriage was resolved, and that Hughes threatened to kill her on numerous occasions throughout their 12-year relationship. There were few, if any, shelters for women back then. There were no women's shelters. So there was no safe place for her to go. Like, where was she supposed to go? Reasonably.
Yeah. There needs to be a underground system where women can where other families can bring in a woman who, and maybe their children or whoever, to help them escape shit like this.
Well, there are shelters do that now, but
shelters aren't necessarily safe either. And especially if the husband thinks that that person's went to a shelter,
We've talked about that before on this podcast, how much like friendship can save your life. But that is one of the biggest things about any type of abuse is how isolation. Isolating it is.
Yeah. And the son actually says that as well. You know, it's amazing how perceptive these kids were. Like I said, the daughter was like 7 when she took the stand, and the son was older. But even at the time, I mean, he's saying like he would not let her have friends. He would not let her have family around.
Yeah.
Like he isolated her completely, mm-hmm. you know, so that she was completely within his control. So the prosecution held steady that while what Mickey did was terrible, it was not justification for premeditated murder. They also dug through Francine's past and found that during one of those stints when she'd managed to go to school for a short while, during her marriage to Mickey, she had struck up a romance with a man that she had met there and had written love letters, which were presented at court. But the plan kind of backfired on the prosecution because the letters, they were really innocent and sweet, and they kind of just made Francine look even more sympathetic because it was obvious that this was just a guy who was nice to her and had given her mm-hmm. just like the tiniest amount of like kindness and attention. And that's what she was seeking out in him. It's not like these were some like scandalous.
Steamy. Yeah.
And she'd only spent time with him like one or two times. So it really, it didn't work the way that I think that they were hoping it would. And also just evil. Like to me, I'm just like to actively dig through her past and try and find other motivations that she could have had to kill him other than the fact that he beat the shit out of her all the time.
Right.
Like, okay. So the below is directly from the New Yorker. Her lawyer invoked an idea that would come to be known as battered women syndrome, a term coined by the psychologist Lenore Walker based on her research with abused women in the U.S. and the U.K. Walker identified an assemblage of psychological symptoms, fear, guilt, and denial, that occurs in victims of intimate partner abuse. This combination, which has since been classed as a form of PTSD, can make discerning the level of risk in a given moment amid an ongoing pattern of trauma difficult. The defense worked. Hughes was acquitted. A jury of 10 women and 2 men found her not guilty by reason of insanity of Hughes's murder. It was an unexpected victory for her and for the feminist movement.
Good.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I just like to say, I think that that story is really important, and I'm so glad that you told that.
I'm not done yet.
This year. No, I'm just saying that, like, this year, especially with how how bad mental health is and how much the rates of domestic violence have skyrocketed from quarantine. And also just anyone that's in a shitty situation, even if it's not as extreme as her, it's just really hard and like to get out of. You know, I talked to you guys earlier today is like I filed the last of my paperwork fucking finally 3 years later from a divorce. And mine wasn't like an abusive situation, but change is hard. And change under duress is even harder.
And I think that those psychological symptoms can be the same no matter the scale of the abuse, right? Which can make it difficult to get out of. And the reason why I usually don't like take full excerpts from things like that, but I wanted to make it clear, you know, to people, because I feel
sometimes
like
sometimes you have to.
I feel like even now people don't understand why women can't just go, like why they can't just leave. Right. I know I grew up feeling that way, you know, at times I'd be like, I don't understand. Just like, why can't you just do this thing? Because, and there's a psychological reason why, you know, that makes it very difficult. So her acquittal was really only the beginning. After her acquittal, burning bed syndrome or battered women syndrome became something studied by academics that was used as a defense in other cases of women killing their abusers. In 1980, there was a nonfiction book by Faith McNulty that was written called The Burning Bed. And 4 years later, they made a TV movie starring Farrah Fawcett that premiered on NBC.
I remember.
Yes. And the movie premiered with a household share of 36.2, ranking it the 17th highest rated movie to air on network television and NBC's highest rated television movie. And this movie, I remember hearing about it and also like it was really important because of the way it depicted domestic violence, kind of similar to like What's Love Got to Do with It, but it predated that by like 10 years, mm-hmm. where they didn't gloss over anything. There was nothing glamorous about it. It was horrifying and it very scary, you know? So it was hailed, that movie was hailed by critics and, you know, even named the 7th greatest American TV movie of all time.
Wow.
By the time the movie came out in 1984, there was a National Domestic Violence Awareness Week. So, I mean, think about that. Think about everything up until 1977. In 1976, you've got a New York City councilman saying, like, I don't know, I think men can beat their wives, basically. And then by mm-hmm. 1984, largely because of this case, there was a National Domestic Violence Awareness Week. It made huge gains in a very short period of time. And then a decade after that, in 1994, talk about not being that long ago, you guys, Congress mm-hmm. passed the Violence Against Women Act, which established a national domestic violence hotline, forced all states and jurisdictions to recognize and enforce victim protection orders, and provided funding for domestic violence training for law enforcement officers, among other provisions. But I mean, that's insane. Like, I was alive. Like, it's crazy. Yeah. That it took that long. After the trial, Francine pursued her dream of becoming a nurse. She graduated valedictorian from nursing school and went on to become a licensed practicing nurse who worked in nursing homes. And after she retired, she would return to the nursing homes to sit with the elderly. And she also taught nursing class. Francine got sick with pneumonia in November of 2016 and never quite recovered. She died of complications on March 22nd, 2017. A GoFundMe was set up for her funeral. The goal was $5,000. They raised almost $10,000, and everything wow. over that $5,000 goal was donated to Safe Place, which was a shelter for battered women.
Nice.
By the time Francine Hughes died in 2017, domestic violence had been recognized as a major national issue, but of course it's not resolved. Even today, 20 people per minute are physically abused by their intimate partner, and 1 in 4 women and 1 in 9 men will be victims of severe physical abuse by an intimate partner during their lifetime. 3 women in America are killed by a partner every day, and male partners are responsible for nearly half of the murders of women in the United States. So I want to close this out by saying, if you're experiencing domestic violence, or if someone you know is experiencing domestic violence, you can call the National Domestic Violence Hotline at 1-800-799-7233, or you can chat with a worker online at www.thehotline.org.
Mm. It's really moving.
I was really nervous to do it because it's kind of outside of what we usually do, but I think it's important.
No, it's so good.
And it's really important this year. And not only that, like, we're looking at it through the lens of like the United States, you know, if you zoom out a little bit and still think about what's happening to little girls and women mm-hmm. all mm-hmm. over the world, it blows my mind. And this is really fucking random, but there's a story that Neil Gaiman writes for The Sandman. It's The Dream of a Thousand Cats, where like there's a little kitten that goes to see like this tomcat speak. And he's like, no, we used to be really big and we were the rulers of the world and the humans were tiny mm-hmm. and they served us. And so he's like, all we have to do is like dream again. And enough of us dream the same dream, then it'll go back to the true reality, which is cats rule the world. And I think about that sometimes because I'm
like, I feel like Chuck already thinks that.
I'm like, sorry. Why is it so patriarchal? Like, whose dream is that? That men are the bosses in so many, like, why we're, there's more of
biblical.
Us. There's more of us. We're more than half the population on this planet.
Well, for here's humans, the thing.
And I just don't understand why.
Well, I have thoughts on that, but I'm not going to go
there.
Yeah,
you have a whole podcast about it.
I'm not going to go there on this here podcast right this moment. But what I will say is that, like, with any movement, right, if you want to just broaden it, whether it be like the women's movement, civil rights movement, anything that happens within those movements happen because we're all dreaming the same dream. Right. Mm-hmm. Like, not to get weird and sappy, but that is how it works. If enough people change their minds about a thing and all get on the same page, you can move, you can shift perceptions, and you can shift the way we're going. You can turn this boat around at any moment. Never feel like you're powerless, because if enough people, there's more of us than there are of them. You're exactly right. And I'm not just mm-hmm. talking like men and women. I'm talking about like everything.
People who feel
decent
this way.
People. Yeah. Good you're people. Talking about decent people.
Right. There are more with of empathy. Us than there are of them. All we have to do is dream the same dream. Right? Like, mm-hmm. it's true.
I'm so on my period for this talk. You got me like, wiping my eyes over here.
Allergies.
Like, I was wondering if it was dusty over there. Is that dusty? The allergies. The name of this episode better fucking be allergies. Oh, Jesus.
Oh, my God. No, it was so good. Thank you.
That was great. Great. Now it's my turn. What am I going to come up with? My whole week is just going to be me on anxiety meds.
Oh, my gosh. You scrolling through ID. That's literally just like, I'm like, what am I going to do next? I don't know.
I just don't want to do another one that's so fucking long as the last one I did. Like, once I started getting into that last story, I was like,
sometimes
Jesus
that
Christ.
Happens,
story
man.
Was meaty.
Yeah, it was.
Meaty.
It needed to be long because there was a lot in there. A lot of info. Yeah.
Jesus.
Yeah.
Well, what are you guys watching?
Ugh, you dude, don't even.
Oh, you're Real still Wildwives. On Real Housewives.
Okay, yes, but here's the thing. But here's the thing, though. I'll shift gears. I'll shift gears and talk about like, I did get a new book on Audible, which we still do have our Audible code.
That's right.
Don't even remember what it is, but we can find it and put in the show notes for you if you want to check it out.
Oh my God, I'll totally do that.
But I listened to What Alice Forgot, which was by Lane Moriarty, or is it Leanne? I'm not sure how you pronounce her first name.
I think it's Leanne.
Leanne. So she's the person who wrote Big Little Lies.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I love her writing, and I think her audiobooks are always good. So I listened to that one, and it was very good. So if you're, you know, kind of in that space, it's not, some of hers are more thrillerish-ish. This one wasn't quite like that, but I did enjoy it greatly. So there's your non-housewife content
for
the week.
Well, I talked about it earlier, but I watched The Queen's Gambit on Netflix.
Is it good? I saw the ad for that, and it looked good.
You know what? It is really good. It is a little bit predictable, but the fucking look of the show is impeccable. Mm-hmm. Holy shit. And I'm a nerd. I like chess, and I like movies about chess and that sort of thing.
At first, I thought you said, I like chests. And I was like, I mean, who doesn't like a chest, a good chest?
But yeah, it's really entertaining. It's really cute. There's a couple moving parts in it. There's one part that made me cry because I miss my dad.
Oh.
And yeah, like I said, it made me want to buy cigarette pants and made me want to pull out a chessboard. And yeah.
We can do both of those things.
Yeah. All
I have a Pirates of the Caribbean chessboard at my house. Oh. So
that's awesome.
I know what you're getting for Christmas.
I did start making my Christmas list this year. Because, I mean, what else are you going to do when you're job hunting? You do everything possible to do other things other than hunt
the
for
amount
jobs?
Of procrastination when it's something that like you actually have to do is incredible. I do the same thing.
Yeah.
So I started making my Christmas list.
I love it. I'm so excited for the holidays. I really am. Even though they're going to look completely different than they have in the past, I just want to bake cookies. I want my house to smell like cinnamon. I'm ready.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Same.
I'm just still watching Rizzoli and Isles. I'm actually really getting into it. I remember Chris had tried to get me into it before, and I was kind of like, meh. But
when you had like other things to do in your
right
when I had life and I could leave and do stuff.
I could leave.
Dude, it is actually funny, the television that I'm like, dude, I rediscovered my love for fixer upper shows.
Ooh,
like HGTV when they renovate a house. I've always kind of liked them, but I got like too excited for one the other day where I'm like, what is happening?
Look, man, we're all people we didn't think we would be. Did you think so that true. I would go through 5 seasons?
Okay. Wow. Who are you?
In like a month's time.
Some of us deal with this different ways. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, we got to cope. Yeah, we got to find ways to cope. Okay. Like, I am actually going to start. You know what? You guys will be very happy to know. I'm going to transition off of Real Housewives and I am going to watch the marriage show, whatever, Married at First Sight. I'm going to do it.
Yeah, I'm going to switch gears. It's good.
And you know what?
Can't wait.
The fact is, there's good shit that I could be watching. 100%.
Oh, yeah, no.
And like, here I am just like, you know what? Trash.
Oh, yeah. I forget if it's HBO or Netflix is coming out with like for the rest of the year, like every Wednesday, a brand new true crime documentary.
Ooh.
All
right. I just saw that the other day and I forgot to bookmark it. So
do they want me to be completely unproductive? Like,
oh yeah, that's, I mean, if that's the goal, here I am.
I mean, they're kind of doing God's work if you think about it, because I'm like, okay, now I it's distracting me from wanting to go out, so they're saving lives.
Yeah, well, I didn't want to end this on a bummer, but I really feel like it's, since we talked about domestic violence, I think it's important to also talk about something that's real life that's happening in my life, and that is, I just found out I lost one of my hair friends to completing suicide, and it's been a really fucking tough day for me, and I just found out, and I think that, you know, hopefully this podcast is a escape for you, and hopefully this is something that can get your mind off the real life shit that's happening day to day in 2020, and it sucks for everybody. But I want to also put in our show notes the suicide prevention hotline, and I want everybody to know that if you just need an ear, you need somebody to talk to, you need an escape, fuck, hit me up. I'm on Facebook, I'm on Twitter, I'm on Instagram, I'm everywhere. I'm not truly the best at replying, I will say, but I'll keep my eyes peeled. And you know what? It's tough times for everybody right now. And whatever you're going through, I just want everybody to know that, you know, we're here for you and we're sending you virtual hugs and we know it's tough. And, you know, you're not alone. You're just not alone.
And no feeling is permanent.
That's right.
I always tell myself that when I'm going through a depressive episode, because I have them. I know all three of us have them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's important to remember this feeling that you're feeling right now, it's not permanent. It will pass. And there are better days ahead, I promise. So our DMs are open. They're open. Reach out. Talk to somebody.
Sometimes it's nice, too. Like, you know, we are such proponents of therapy, but sometimes it's nice to just have somebody who's not necessarily connected to you, connected to your family, or in such a, you know, somebody separate to talk to. And if that's what you need, you know what, if I can be that for you, great. If you need connections, or if you need numbers, if you need people who can be there for you in a professional way, we can get that information to you. So we love you so much. That's,
absolutely.
You know,
there's a reason
want.
Why we've been saying that at the end of the episode, because I do feel like this year, especially like if the podcast is an escape for you to listen to, it's definitely an escape for us to make once a week. It's something that I cling to almost like a buoy of normalcy.
Me too.
Of like, well, this is something I have to do in a year where so many things have been shed away from me. I lost my band this year. I lost my job this year. Some of it, you know, by my choice, but still, I'm just like, out of all of the things I had to do at the beginning of this year, that now I'm like, they're not there anymore. And it's, we say we love you so much at the end of the episode, not just for the listens or the Patreon or the reviews, which are all very nice, but because we need you as much as you might need us. Mm-hmm. It's a big part of keeping us sane in 2020 as well. So I will make sure that that is up on the show notes, the domestic violence and the suicide prevention hotlines, because I know this year, as rough as it's been for us, it may be rougher for other people. And we want to let you know that we're here for you and that there's a place you can go to reach out, get help if you need it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, on that note, I know that we always go out with inviting you to send stories and all those great things. But I think more than anything tonight, we just want you to know that we love you so much. And
cheers.
This is a Blast Box Media Podcast.